Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and as always, I'm so glad you could join me today for a little bit of classic cardboard talk as we go deep into the storage boxes and folders with plastic pages and the top loaders all scattered around your little collection of baseball cards from your childhood and your present tense. And wouldn't it be nice if we could all get a second chance to correct a wrong? I don't know how many movies have been made with that as a plot or a subplot. The opportunity, when you screw something up, to, if not go back and redo it, kind of like Groundhog Day, or the opportunity to kind of make amends for it, get a second chance to do it right in real time. There's many romantic comedies that have been made like that. And the second chance after a failed first opportunity, and that is the basis for the set that we're going to be talking about in this episode. A set that not only got it right the second time around, but was so popular when it came out. The same design was essentially used the following year for this particular set. And from a time belovedly and begrudgingly known as the junk wax era, of course, talking late 80s and early 90s, this is one of the few sets that has incredible staying power. Not necessarily in the value of the cards. I think it's safe to say many of the cards from the junk wax era, with a few exceptions, you're not going to get a ton of money for. You might get a good return on your investment, but you're not going to get a ton of money for each and every individual card. But I think in terms of just appreciation for the set, and in terms of what this set was able to do for a couple of years in a very competitive environment, and it is still beloved 25 years later, says an awful lot about how good this set was. Actually, more than 25 years, 27 years and counting. We're talking about 1992 Fleer Ultra. This is a set that I've always enjoyed. I enjoyed it back in the day when it came out. I enjoyed the set that came out in 93. Like I said, it was very similar to the 92 set. And fans still love it, so much so that it was actually a listener suggestion that we bring some 92 Fleer Ultra into the fold. And I said, absolutely. As Nathan McNeely, we mentioned this in the previous show, he made a cash donation to our tip jar, if you will, at paypal.me/waxecstatic. And he said that he enjoyed the show, but he also wanted to hear some 92 Fleer Ultra talk. And I said, yep, we can do that. Now, I'm not always pay for play. You know, if you give me money and make a suggestion, I'm not always going to be able to follow that up. However, because Nathan made a nice contribution, and it was right in the wheelhouse as to how much a box of 92 Fleer Ultra would cost, I was able to procure that very quickly. And I mentioned that we originally discussed 92 Fleer Ultra back in, it would have been the spring, maybe early summer of 2017. If you go through our archives on your RSS feed or at our home base at audioboom.com, you will find the 92 Fleer Ultra show. I think it was Albert Bell, I believe, was our random poll from the handful of cards I still had. And even then, 2-3 years ago, I was still lauding over this particular set. And that says how good of a set it was, in the sense that, you know, in the 2 or 3 years I've done this show, actually 3 years I've done the show now, my thoughts about several sets that at first I didn't really care much for, you know, have turned around over time. You know, 88 Tops is a prime example. Also, 70 Tops, actually, you know, going back through some of those cards, I've had a better appreciation for the set than when I first reviewed it a couple of years ago on this program. So the fact that 92 Fleer Ultra stuck with me 27 years ago, remained with me 2-3 years ago when we reviewed it, and is still one of my favorites, to where when somebody suggests that we go out and talk about this and purchase some and make a show out of it like Nathan did, absolutely, that's an easy one. So Nathan, thank you for your contribution. Thank you for the suggestion as well. And one of the many great things about 92 Fleer Ultra, which we'll bring up in the program today, is even though it is part of the junk wax era, there's good and bad to that. The good is that there's plenty of it that's out there. The bad, of course, is that if you're looking for individual value on some of these cards, unless you pull one of those Tony Gwynn autograph cards, it's not going to be too much of a return on your investment. But when you're talking junk wax, you're typically looking at just opening up some cards for fun and sorting through them and getting some great deals. And you can certainly get that with 92 Fleer Ultra. Now, as I've mentioned, even though I'm not pay for play, I do like to extend the offer. If you would like to make a cash donation to Wax Ecstatic, you can do so at paypal.me/waxecstatic. And any dollar amount, whether it's just a handful of dollars or if it's around $20, $25, or God bless you if it's even more than that, go ahead and make that, because your money goes back into the program in one of two ways. First of all, purchasing the products that we talk about. So, for example, Nathan suggested we talk more 92 Fleer Ultra. We had the funds for it, quickly went out and found some on eBay at a good price, and we've turned an entire show into that. So that's how it works. Also, when we have listener suggestions, even if there isn't a cash donation, but if we have listener suggestions to seek out specific cards or talk about some harder to find cards, when the monthly card show comes through here in the Tampa Bay area, I will actively look for it. And that's actually what I did this past weekend when the show was in town. We had some suggestions for the 3D cards, the Kellogg's 3D cards from the late 70s and early 80s, the post-serial cards. And I was able to, lo and behold, one of the dealers I normally go to had a bunch of them. And of course, in a bargain box, I think I bought probably 10 or 12 of these cards for about, $4 or $5. It wasn't that much. So our next show, which will be coming your way in 2 weeks, we will be discussing some of those cards that I was able to find at a local show. That next show, by the way, will be on Friday, December 6th, dropping at noon Eastern on Audio Boom and all of the channels that link up to us. So we'll be taking a look at the 3D cards. We'll be looking at some post cards. And also, I'm going to throw in just some other random finds that I've had at card shows recently. I've been able to pick up some really, really nice vintage cards, and you know, they're not in great shape, they're beaten up because they're old and they're in a bargain bin, so I'm not looking for a PSA 10. You're lucky if some of these are a 1 in some cases. But being able to pick up recently a Indian Gum 1934 baseball card, picked up a couple of 1948 Leaf baseball cards as well, and added a few more to my Ted Williams collection, the 1959 Ted Williams Fleer set, which I've had a little more respect for. I understand why it didn't work in 1959. It's just people wanted current ball players and an assortment of ball players, not just a set dedicated to one Ted Williams. Especially if you weren't a Red Sox fan, you probably didn't care about Ted Williams. But you can find some of those cards in pretty decent shape at decent prices. Picked up three more from the $3 for $5 box, and to have a 60-year-old baseball card focusing on Ted Williams, there's some added value to that. So we'll discuss all of that in the next show. And again, thanks again to the contributions from the Wax Ecstatic PayPal account. Now, another way that your cash donation gets put into good use is every few months I collect all of the excess product, whether it's from purchases that we've made for this show, or even sometimes it's my own personal purchases. You know, I picked up some Topps Heritage recently, had a few dupes, stacked them all up, put them in a box, and every few months we take a few boxes of cards, a couple thousand at any given time, and we donate them to Commons for Kids. We're big fans of Commons for Kids, who will collect your common sports cards and divvy them up and donate them to children's hospitals, to charities, to kids who just need something good and positive and happy in their life, but also to kids who just can't afford baseball cards. We all know that they're a little pricey these days. So what better way to keep kids involved in the hobby and in the sport and keep them out of trouble than with a donation to Commons for Kids? If these kids can get their hands on baseball cards and look up not only current players, but also past players, that's always a good thing. And even though Commons for Kids will take some of your junk wax era common cards, make sure you throw in some current, some contemporary stuff as well, so that they have a nice mix of old and new, and it's not just you merely cleaning out your closets. Give them some good stuff as well. And Commons for Kids will be receiving a shipment from us, again, probably in about 2 or 3 months as we continue to add up the cards here. I think we've got probably about 1,000 cards set aside already since our last delivery, based on cards that we've received for this show, but also, again, just cleaning out personal collections. It's definitely a good place to send your comments to. And I've had a couple listeners reach out to me about Commons for Kids, trying to figure out how to connect with them and where to send the cards to. And you can find them on Twitter, by the way, at Commons for Kids, and that's for the number four. So Commons, the number four, and Kids, and give them a follow as they are listeners of our program as well. We're big supporters of them, and we're glad that they are supporters of us. Now, like I said, the next Wax Ecstatic will be coming your way on Friday, June the 6th. We'll be talking about those cereal box cards, the Hostess cards, the 3D cards, plus some great vintage finds. And we certainly hope that you will mark your calendar and be on the lookout for that program again on December 6th. And for all the latest news from Wax Ecstatic, just give us a follow on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains, as we are open 24/7. It's a great place to talk about not only the cards that we feature on the show, or maybe some of the stories of the players that we have on the show, but also just anything involving the hobby. And you can tag us in any other conversations. Let her rip, basically. Just talk about whatever you want to talk about involving the hobby. It's always fun to look into some of these conversations and see what fans are talking about. Again, about the hobby in general, or the sport in general, or baseball cards, or the teams, or the players. We're certainly looking forward to you chiming in again at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Now, before I get into some of the recent comments on our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed, as you hear in the background, the annoying neighbor with the annoying motorcycle, or if you listen carefully, you might be able to hear some wind chimes. Normally, me being a purveyor of very quality, high quality podcasting here, you know, when I can speak English, that's always a good sign, but always trying to give you a well-produced program, not just good stuff to talk about, but making it sound good. I'm actually making an exception to one of my many rules about podcasting, and that is that you need to find a quiet room to do your podcast recording, or if you're doing it live, you have to find a quiet room that you can do that with. Well, today in my studio, I have opened up the windows here, because as I'm sitting here about to pontificate about 92 Fleer Ultra and sharing your comments from the last couple of weeks from Wax and Gum Stains, it is sunny. It is 67 degrees. There is a slight breeze, about 10, 12 miles an hour. And when you live in Florida like I do, you love these days. And it's not only to piss off everybody north of you, because it's probably about 12 degrees wherever you are listening to this, but it's just winter in Florida. This is why you live here, because summer is pure hell. And it wasn't until about 2 weeks ago that we finally had high temperatures below 80 degrees. And now we've got this really nice, pleasant, wintry, I shouldn't even call it wintry, because it is 67 degrees, for crying out loud. So it's nice and pleasant. And we normally don't get this until December, yet here we are a few days before Thanksgiving, and we're getting this nice, cool, brisk weather experience here for a few days. So it's hard for me, sitting in my studio, to sit here with the windows closed, and I'm in my solitary confinement doing this program, when it's sunny and it's 67 and it's breezy, and this is a great way to not only air condition the house, but, you know, kind of get some fresh air in here. You know, make it smell a little better too. So forgive me if you hear wind chimes, or the wind itself, or maybe an occasional airplane, or that asshole driving his stupid motorcycle down the street. We will enjoy the outdoors indoors this week, although I will promise you in future shows, we will close up the doors and windows and keep the weather outdoors. But again, this is such a rare occurrence. It's been at least a good seven, 8 months since we've had a day where it was 67 degrees here. And considering during the summer, you sweat just walking from your front door to your car at 8 a.m, we will gladly take this. And I'm going to experience this for just a little bit. So go ahead and please help me, allow me to indulge in this experience of having the windows open, despite the noise and the slight knockdown of a peg or two of our podcast production. All right, let's get to wax and gum stains. A lot of commentary from our last program, which was on the random selection of cards found in one of those Walgreens card packs. It's a blister pack. You have 100 cards plus a quote-unquote bonus pack, which, much to the horror of our listeners, was a 1990 Donruss wax pack. And I will be using that 1990 Donruss wax pack as well as the 89 Bowman rack pack. There he goes again. I will be using the 1990 Donruss wax pack and the 89 Bowman rack pack as a threat against humanity if we don't continue to get cash donations at paypal.me/waxecstatic. So just your biweekly reminder, you have been warned. But despite the 1990 Donruss wax pack, a lot of people enjoyed not only the program and the assortment of cards that we had in there, but it actually encouraged some people to share the stories of some of the cards that they found in those drugstore blister packs. And also, it encouraged some people to go out and find these, actually buy them up there. And like I said in the show, you're not necessarily going to get a land of riches from one of these things, but for $5 or $6, if you went by book value of each and every card, you're probably going to end up with at least 10, maybe upwards of $15 or $20 worth of cards, depending what you have in here. Not that you're going to painstakingly look all of them up and painstakingly sell them to make your money back, but the point is, there is a good return on the investment. And you add that just to the fun of opening up a mystery pack of 100 cards, it's actually a pretty good buy. It was fun. And while I won't hoard these, if I ever find myself in a situation where I just happen to have $5 and I just happen to be in Walgreens and there just happens to be one of those blister packs, I might just pick it up. So let's start with Bogsy, who's sharing the story about a drugstore blister pack he picked up a few years ago. He says, no joke, I pulled an 83 Fleer Gwynn out of one of those a few years ago. $7 well spent, randomly grabbed it in a Sports Authority in, of all places, San Diego. Now that is a hit. Never mind the autograph card or the jersey card, whatever. You get a Gwynn rookie out of one of these bad boys. That alone pays for it. And then some. So good find there, Bogsy, and thanks for sharing that story. AudioLux7 says, hard to beat that kind of fun for $5. Plus, I've pulled some decent stuff from when I had stopped collecting out of those Fairfield boxes. Yeah, like I said, we've found some pretty interesting things there. And a good assortment, too. Like when I was going through the cards, because I didn't collect anything new from 95 till about 2003, 2004, I actually, the handful of cards, there were a couple from 96 Donruss, like a 99 Tops, I think a 2001 Tops, you know, the sets that I didn't really bother to collect at that time. I hung onto those cards just to say I have some, so, you know, I was able to add to my set even with some of the common cards that were in there. John Grachowski, that was a great podcast. Thank you very much, John. I hope I didn't totally butcher your call there or your name there. Brian Kilby says in discussions with other fans about this particular product, he said, I happened to be in Walgreens at 1 a.m. and my brain's executive functions were impaired due to lack of sleep. It's always a good time to go out and buy something, Brian. At $5, it's not too bad, and 1 in 4 packs contains a hit. Well, I hope you found something decent in there. Let's see what he's got here. So he found a Nolan Ryan, I think Pacific did these cards back in 1992, the Cowboy Life Nolan Ryan. What else we got here? A Scott Deal autographed Bowman Chrome card. Let's see. Gary Carter, a couple of Gary Carter cards, 92 top or 91 tops, excuse me, 93 tops as well. A slew of early 80s cards, including the dreaded manager card for Danny Ozark, 85 tops there. Also got, looks like a couple of 86 tops in here, 84 tops, George Wright, 83 Fleer, and an 82 Topps card of one of my favorite players, not because he was a great player, but he had a great name. Talking, of course, Johnny Walkenfuss of the Detroit Tigers. And he shares several other pictures here. So if you check out the Wax and Gum Stains timeline, you'll see the bounty that he was able to pick up in one of these cards. Always, or one of these card packs. Always a good buy, again, at 1 in the morning if you find yourself in Walgreens. Von Spalding writes to us, "I really enjoy your podcast. Thank you very much. Especially the last episode featuring the Walgreens repack. As someone who used to work for Walgreens, I used to talk cards with people who bought those boxes. Since I don't live near a show or store, those boxes are one of the few opportunities to buy cards in person. The best cards I have pulled from those boxes include a jersey card of Alfonso Soriano and Vlad Guerrero, a 1969 Don Buford, and a Chipper Jones rookie. And after the last episode, I got another box. I got a 1971 Topps Marv Staley." Well, good for you. Marv Staley is, of course, one of the favorite names of the early 70s to share with the baseball fans. But the fact that you found a 71 Topps card, I hope it was in really good condition. Because having a 71 Topps card in anywhere close to mint condition is pretty impressive. And the fact that one found its way into the blister pack is also very impressive. Let's see, Tim Curry giving us a shout out here. "Thanks for the mention of the latest episode. Very much appreciated. I just recently caught up to episode number 141 from late September, and I must say that your Harry Carey impression is the best I've heard. Pretty much spot on."
Thank you very much, Tim Curry. I'm so glad you listened to the program. I love you as Pennywise. Always better to be penny wise than pound foolish.
Okay, Harry, pound foolish, fine for three. Oh, no, that's my Steve Stone impression. All right, Wax Pack 916, talking about Bob Hamlin. Of course, that was one of the cards that we found in the blister pack. "I met Mr. Hamlin at the National this past August. He was great with everyone, taking pictures and chatting. Great episode. I like opening those boxes once in a while." And he shares a couple of the autograph cards that he got from Bob Hamlin, including the 90 Upper Deck, which we found in that blister pack. And Bob Hamlin seems to be taking his 15 minutes of fame rather nicely. And again, it's just a mind-blowing story of how he just walked away from the game, quite literally just walked away from the game when he was playing for Toledo in AAA back in 1999. A guy who was the American League Rookie of the Year, who struggled to get his way up into the major leagues, especially because of, first of all, George Brett kind of standing in the way. You know, he was still playing, so Hamlin had limited opportunities and then had to deal with numerous injuries and health conditions. Finally gets that chance in 94, wasn't able to live up to expectations after, and in 1999 just gets up and goes away. It was just absolutely amazing how that story played out. And one last mention here on Wax and Gum Stains from Ryan Cornell sends us a picture of a 72 Topps Bob Aspromonte card. And he says, 72 Topps Bob Aspromonte, number 659, was invited to Reds camp but never played a game with them. And he emailed me asking for more details, or if I know, as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story. Well, the cards back then, remember 1972, Topps was still releasing sets in series of cards. You still had, it would have been six series of cards back then, if I recall correctly. I think the set was still 660 cards. And Bob Aspromonte had been around, even though he was at the end of his career, he had been around the major leagues for a very long time. So it wasn't really going out on a limb for Topps to put out a card for him in the 1972 set. And the fact that they saved him for a very high number card, you know, one of the last cards in the last series, tells you that they were basically taking a flyer on him and thinking that Aspro would, if not get picked up by the Reds after the spring training invite, would be able to latch on somewhere and keep his pro career going for at least another season or two. And that, of course, wasn't the case for Aspromonte. So if you look closely at the picture, you can see that It is clearly a spring training picture. Now, he's wearing the Reds' road uniform, so somewhere on the road during 1972 spring training, a Topps photographer got that picture of him in the Reds' uni, and even though he never played for them, Topps included him in the set because, again, even though he didn't get into the Reds' starting lineup or even on the roster after training camp, I'm sure they figured that he was going to get hired by somebody, and it just didn't work out that way. Certainly not the first time that a card has been produced where the player is no longer playing, and it was just a gamble by Topps, or whoever the producer is. It was just a gamble to think that that player would still be playing or have at least one more season under his belt, and it just wasn't the case. So thank you very much for all the commentary on Wax and Gum Stains. Again, open 24/7. And we certainly appreciate all comments, questions, suggestions, pictures, stories, you name it. Make sure you share those stories and pictures and everything else with the hobby community at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. All right, let's get to the main topic of this week's podcast, 92 Fleer Ultra. And as I started the show out with, it was really the great second chance for Fleer and Fleer Ultra. You may recall a few months ago, I did a show on 91 Fleer Ultra. And the only reason why I did a show on 91 Fleer Ultra is this was just one of those mercy boxes, one of those bargain bin beauties that I found at the local card show. And if I recall, I think it was part of a 2 for $11 or a $3 for $15 sale, something like that. I got it incredibly dirt cheap. And I figured, well, why the hell not? And I opened them up and, you know, kind of got this feeling of, you know, 91 Fleer Ultra really was not that bad of a set. But what caused 91 Fleer Ultra some problems was, while it was not bad, it was certainly not great. And when you looked at the other premium sets that came out in 1991, most notably the Topps Stadium Club debut, Fleer Ultra was far, far behind what Topps Stadium Club was. And you look at some of the other premium sets that were also getting cranked up, as well as some quality product in the base set with Upper Deck, as always, in 1991. It was still a long, long way for Fleer Ultra. So it was a good debut, but seriously lacked in what a lot of the competition was offering. And of course, the rather unfavorable review of the 1991 Fleer base set did not help Ultra's cause. So Fleer had an opportunity to kind of reimagine what their premium set was going to be in 1992. They had a chance to hit the reset button, and as with many things in life, you often don't get a chance to press the reset button, and you certainly don't when it comes to a product or a service. Normally, when you roll out something that's botched at the beginning, you may have a second chance, but you often have to overcome a lot of obstacles to kind of set the record straight and go, no, no, really, this is what we were trying to accomplish. And only major companies with a ton of money behind them, like the Walt Disney Company is a great example I can think of, only companies like that can normally change the narrative practically overnight to, no, this is what we were trying to deliver, and people will do that. In fact, on my personal business site, salmonsays.com, I recently posted a story about the kind of bungled launch to Disney Plus, the OTT service that Disney's offering. And there were a lot of people just guffawing at Disney going, whoa, how can they launch something and it, you know, doesn't work the first day, or doesn't work right, or it's not consistently working. And I compared it to the opening of Disneyland in Anaheim, where it was the exact same thing, where everything that could go wrong on opening day in 1955 at Disneyland did, and quite spectacularly wrong. Yet Disney, and in particular Walt Disney, made it his passion moving forward to daily make the theme park even better. And you know, with Disney Plus, Disney the company is going to daily make Disney Plus better. So the reason why I bring up Disney is that they've got the money, they've got the time, they've got the backing, they've got the brand legacy to be able to quickly change the narrative to go, nope, this is what we were striving for. Okay, we goofed up a few times at the beginning, but this is what we were striving to do. Fleer didn't exactly have that capital in 1992. So it's amazing that they were able to press that reset button and not only press it and go, oops, no, this is what we were trying to do. But when they released that product in 1992, it was spectacular. And it still is. It's a joy to open up 92 or 93, as the case may be, because they are very similar designs, similar products. It's fun to open up the FLIR Ultra from 92 and 93. And in 1992, FLIR Ultra was not messing around. Like, you could still see in 91, they kind of had some of the old school baseball tricks up their sleeve, where they released a set that was called premium, even though it wasn't exactly premium. All right, it looked different than the base set, certainly looked better than the base set, and you could compare it to other sets that were out in 91, but it wasn't like they were serious about it. Well, when they got smacked around and nobody was buying their product in 91, well, they got serious about it in 1992. Give credit to the minds at FLIR for realizing, okay, premium sets are where the hobby is going. We need to actually put out a premium with a capital P set in 1992. And in the 91 set, you had the Ultra Team cards. That was your insert. It was basically just this glorified all-star insert set. Again, kind of toyish, childish, who cares? They were having none of that in 92. Now you had the award winners subset in Series 1, where you had Gold Glove winners, Cy Young Award winners, you know, anybody who basically came home with a personal trophy in 1991. You had this very glossy, nicely done, truly randomly inserted insert card throughout Series 1, whereas the Ultra Team wasn't necessarily an insert. It was kind of part of the base set, and there wasn't anything special about it. And then one other notable thing in the 92 FLIR Ultra set that shows you that FLIR was deadly serious about not repeating the mistakes of 1991, there was no sticker. How can you not have a sticker when you have a FLIR card? But that, again, is a sign of how the hobby was changing from 1991 to 1992. A lot of the bells and whistles, the childish bells and whistles that you used to get in baseball card packs, whether it was a piece of bubblegum or a sticker or a puzzle piece, or the little 3D action trivia question like you found in Score, those were going by the wayside. In fact, I think 92 was the last year Upper Deck was putting hologram stickers in their packs. So all of the cutesy little Cracker Jack type prizes that you got inside each individual pack, gone. Screw that. We're putting out premium quality. And as I've mentioned before, from 91 to 92, even base sets stepped up their games from just base sets into premium looking base sets. And then you had the additional base set, or a premium set, I should say, or premium sets, as the case may be, as brands were starting to branch out a little bit. That was just where the hobby was going at the time. So when you compare 92 FLIR Ultra to 91, it's not just the design of the card, it's just how FLIR completely altered how they were going to approach this whole situation. And it's something that trickled down again from the premium set to the base set. And the 92 FLIR set is a beauty of a set too, the emerald green look, but they too in 92 got rid of the stickers, got rid of the toys. You had the Roger Clemens insert cards there, which were very similar to the award-winning inserts as well. Kind of this glossy black with a little bit of gold foil trim. It was all business. FLIR figured out after 1991, okay, we just got to stop goofing off here. If we don't want to be left in the dust by all of this competition upping their game, we've got to up our game as well. And in the words of the late, great Pat Paulson, we've upped our game, so up yours. And FLIR Ultra certainly did that to all the critics. They basically said, up yours. Look at what we're putting out here. And they put out an absolute winner of a set. 600 total cards, two series, 300 cards in each series. And when I had the opportunity to buy the FLIR Ultra box off of eBay, you had the FLIR Ultra Series 1 box or the Ultra Series 2 box. I spent the extra couple of bucks on the Series 1 box. And I do mean a couple of bucks. I mean, we're talking like $3 or $4. That was the price difference. So it wasn't like a huge sacrifice I was making here. But not just going for the bargain bin beauty, but actually spending a few more bucks for the chance to get not only the award-winning cards, which were the inserts in Series 1, but also a chance at the Tony Gwynn cards. Now, there were two types of Tony Gwynn cards. You had the career retrospective, even though he was still playing and would play for several more years after 1992. Basically, Tony Gwynn became almost the de facto spokesperson for the Fleer Ultra set. And why not? As he was nearing 3,000 hits at the time, the All-Star game was in San Diego that year. This is Mr. Padre Tony Gwynn, and the spotlight was on him. And what better representative to have for your brand than Tony Gwynn? You can't think of too many at the time when you go back to 1992. So you've got these random cards that are thrown in there, but you also have limited edition, and I believe the count is 2,000 autographed Gwynn cards. Now, according to the wrapper, the chance of getting the autographed card was 1 in 17,000. But some people think that the odds are even higher because card companies in the early 90s typically, I don't want to say lied, even though they kind of did, there was a little bit of a misleading as to how many cards were actually produced. So there is some thought out there that the odds are slightly less in your favor of getting a Gwynn autograph card just because there was so much Fleer Ultra product that was made, just like everything else that was made at that time, that the odds may be a little less in your favor. What does that mean? Well, it drives up the value of these cards if you find one. And not just because they are limited edition. There's only 2,000 of them, and there's probably 20 million Fleer Ultra cards out there. But also, and as morbid as this sounds, this is just how hobbies and collectibles work. When a famous person who signed something dies, the value of that signed item typically goes up simply because he's not around to sign it anymore. And of course, Gwynn passing away a few years ago. So the idea that there is still a few, perhaps a couple hundred Tony Gwynn autograph cards floating around, even though the odds are highly against you, is a good reason to spend that extra $3 or $4. Because if you are one of those lucky people to get that Gwynn autograph, congratulations, you're able to pay your mortgage off the sale of that card for at least the next year. And the same goes for, you know, the Ted Williams signed cards from Upper Deck and any other autographed memorabilia from somebody who since has passed. And again, it's very morbid. I hate it when that happens, when somebody famous dies and all of a sudden on eBay, all of this person's autographed stuff or game used stuff or, you know, just a baseball card. You know, here's Jose Fernandez. Here's just one of his cards. And, you know, there's a morbid market that buys it. But that's just how, you know, demand and what you have stocked up, how it works, you know, supply and demand. That's just how it is. So that was one of the reasons why I went and bought out the Series 1 box, because of the award-winning cards, but also the chance to get the Gwynn card. Now, I have opened up the entire box, and there are no Gwynn cards, signed or unsigned, but I did manage to get, I think, 5 or 6 of the award-winning cards, and we're talking some pretty good names, too. You know, Tom Glavine, also Roger Clemens, but, you know, Barry Bonds, and, you know, even an Andy Van Slyke, you know, a Gold Glove winner, but still a very unique card from a semi-star player at the time. And while I haven't gone through the entire stack of cards yet, I like my chances of being able to, if not complete the entire first series, being maybe just 2 or 3 cards shy of the entire first series. Now, there were more duplicates in this box of cards as opposed to the 93 Top Stadium Club Series 1 that I opened up a few months ago, and I was able to complete the building of the entire set with just one box. But if you're looking for an affordable set that looks really good, has some value to it, has some intrigue and the chance of getting that signed Tony Gwynn card, and is relatively easy to put together because one box, if it doesn't complete the set or the series, I should say, you're going to be pretty darn close to completing the series. It is definitely a buy that you want to look into. And as I mentioned before, because it is all part of the junk wax era, there's tons and tons and tons of Fleer Ultra 92 and 93. So you don't have to look too far. You may find it at your nearest baseball card show. In fact, the guy that I normally buy boxes of cards from, he actually had a 92 Fleer Ultra Series 2 box. Now, I didn't buy it. But he was selling it, I believe, for $11, and that's pretty much the going price. The box that I bought with shipping, I think, was $20 or $22. I think the cost of the box itself was $13. So you can get these boxes rather cheaply. You can also pick up not just the wax boxes, quote-unquote wax. Of course, they're foil packs in 1992. But you can also get the fat packs as well. I've seen unopened fat pack boxes of Fleer Ultra up there. A few dollars more because you get a few more cards. But again, you can get those for with shipping under $30. And if you're able to find one at your local shop or local card show, you're maybe spending $15 to $20 on those. So we talk about return on investment, even though you're not going to painstakingly go through all these cards and sell each and every one off, unless you get a Gwyn card. That's the only exception. You go and spend, you know, $20 on a box of cards, you're going to be able to put together an entire series of cards. And if you're lucky, some of those insert cards are equal to $4 or $5, and it kind of pays for the entire box. But like we say, especially with junk wax era cards, it's less the monetary value that you're getting out of these cards and more just the fact that, hey, I'm spending an hour ripping open a box of cards. I'm going to try to collate a set from this. And 92 Fleer Ultra is a beautiful set. Star power, rookie power. You've got some great young career cards. So, you know, I pulled a Ken Griffey Jr., got a couple Frank Thomas cards out of there, Gary Sheffield as well. And of course, the inserts too. There's still a thrill of a chase 27 years later. Can I get these award winner cards? Can I get the Tony Gwynn cards? And even though the odds are very slim in your favor, just that chance. That's why you play those scratch-off lottery tickets, right? Just that chance that you might be lucky enough to win is a good enough reason just to spend a few bucks and rip open this box of cards. So again, I really, really appreciate Nathan sending not only the cash donation to help us purchase this, but also the suggestion to discuss it. 92 Fleer Ultra is an easy one to talk about, an easy set to get behind because it is such a great set. And of course, we all love the comeback story, right? We all love hearing about people who come back from hard times and adversity. This doesn't quite count as adversity, but Fleer and Fleer Ultra clearly were not good products in 1991, and give credit to the people at Fleer for going, all right, this just was not good. We're getting clobbered by the competition. If we want to stay in this game, we need to improve what we're putting out there. And they certainly did, both with the base product and with the premium set in 92. They would continue with that for the next few years. Fleer putting out some good cards, and again, as premium overtook just your standard base set, the Fleer base set kind of got faded out, but Ultra was still a pretty popular product for many years. And, you know, Fleer was able to hang around in the game a little longer than some of the other brands, although they went by the wayside many, many years ago. Now, we found through these four packs, like we like to do, we found four random cards. Take one from each pack and just talk about some of the players here. And one of the cards with the little rookie flag underneath the Fleer Ultra logo is Gary DeSarcina. Boy, talk about a great name. I wish Gary DeSarcina played for the Cubs at some point in his life, because wouldn't have that been a trip to hear Harry Carey introduce, "Now playing shortstop, Gary DeSarcina." Although, you know, Harry's later days, that probably wouldn't have come out that way. It would have been, "Now the shortstop, Gary Descargaloma," or something like that. Would have sounded like an Italian cancer. It's not pleasant when you think about it. But when you look at Gary DeSarcina's career, it rather was pleasant. In fact, he played his entire career over 1,000 games with the California/Anaheim Angels. And quite the story for him, as he was a star of the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and born and raised in Massachusetts, so playing college right there in his backyard, drafted in the sixth round of the 1988 amateur draft by the California Angels. Went up and down throughout the late 80s and early 90s, but finally in 1992 became the shortstop of record after the legendary Dick Schofield was pushed aside. DeSarcina would hold the job as shortstop for the Angels through 1998. He was an American League All-Star in 1995 and was the Angels team MVP in 1998. Played 157 games, had 158 hits that season, 56 RBI, and batted .287. Pretty impressive for a middle infielder. Typically, you're known more for your defense than your offense. Now, he would deal with a lot of injuries over the next few years of his career. In fact, only played 12 games in 2000 after playing only half a season in 1999 due to a broken arm. Tried to make a comeback with the Boston Red Sox after leaving the Angels in 2000. Was able to get a little bit of playing time with the Pawtucket Red Sox in 2002, but didn't work out. So his career reads 1,086 major league games, 966 hits, 20 triples, 28 home runs, 186 doubles, and again, pretty solid defense, all wearing the halo for all of those years. Now, a couple interesting notes about DeSarcina. First of all, a note of infamy is he was the final out of Kenny Rogers' perfect game back on July 28th, 1994, as he popped up to Rusty Greer of the Texas Rangers for the final out of that game. And DeSarcina also mixed up his uniform numbers numerous times. Now, that's very odd. Normally, a player has a uniform number that he likes since, you know, the age of eight in some cases. A lot of the times, it's his favorite player's number, or maybe there's a personal connection, you know, a lucky number in the family, or, you know, your mom or dad's birth year or something like that. Well, he changed his number several times. He wore number 4 in his first season in 1989, later changed to number 11. The final few seasons of his career, he wore number 9, but in 1 year, he changed his number to 33 in tribute to Larry Bird. You know, you can take the infielder out of Massachusetts, but you can't take the Massachusetts out of the infielder. And I know Larry Bird was the hick from French Lick in Indiana, but star with the Boston Celtics for so many years. So nice little tip of the cap there to Larry Bird by Gary DeSarcina wearing number 33. Now, after his playing career ended, he was moving up to the front office of the Boston Red Sox, a baseball operations consultant for several years. Also took a crack at broadcasting, did some studio analysis for NESN, and he became a minor league instructor and manager, was a manager of the Lowell Spinners, and helped them to much success. He returned to the Angels as an assistant to the co-GMs that the team had several years ago, Tony Regans and Jerry DePoto. And he bounced back to the Red Sox organization. He was the manager of the Pawtucket Red Sox in 2013, helped them finish to a first place finish in their division, also got them into the finals of the Cup Championship before they lost to the Durham Bulls. That's the Governor's Cup Championship, I should say. And quite the tale there. You've got the Boston Red Sox prospects in 2013 against the Tampa Bay Rays prospects of 2013. And both teams getting success from a lot of those players over the years. Meanwhile, DeSarcina would get a chance to perhaps manage the Seattle Mariners. He was in contention for that job. The Mariners would rather dubiously hired Lloyd McClendon in his place. So rather than manage Seattle, he joined Mike Socha and the Angels staff in 2014, was at third base for a couple of seasons, and then moved to first base at the end of the 2016 season. Then he moved on to the Boston Red Sox. He was a bench coach in 2017 after John Farrell got let go. He would move on to the Mets, and as of last check, he is still on the Mets coaching staff, although that's always a tenuous position this time of year. He was the third base coach for much of the season after starting the 2018 season as the bench coach under Mickey Callaway. Well, with Callaway gone, the question is, will DeSarcina still stay there in New York? And there is some speculation that DeSarcina may, in fact, get picked up by Joe Maddon, the new manager of the Angels. Of course, Maddon was the bench coach and an interim manager for the Angels in the mid-90s when DeSarcina was playing there. So we'll see how that all pans out. Now, in one of the packs, we pulled out an Anthony Young card. And I sigh when I pull out an Anthony Young card, because Anthony Young was the butt of so many jokes and the scapegoat for the terrible New York Mets teams of the early 90s that I have to sign. Of course, it's even sadder considering he passed away from brain cancer a couple of years ago. He is best known for having lost 27 consecutive games in which he had a decision that set a Major League Baseball record. Now, to clarify that record, because I recall back in 1993 when he set that record, a lot of people thought that he just lost 27 consecutive starts or 27 consecutive appearances, and that is not the case. There were a lot of people comparing his losing streak to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers starting their franchise 0-26 and, you know, this record of futility. Well, Anthony Young, who was better known as AY, didn't lose 27 consecutive starts or 27 consecutive appearances. It's just 27 consecutive times when there was a pitcher of record situation and he was the pitcher of record, he lost the game. Now, this is a guy who actually was able to make quality starts in 13 of those 27 appearances. He also made quite a few saves. He had quite a few holds during this stretch as he was filling in for John Franco, who was the closer. In fact, Young converted 12 straight save opportunities through 23 and two-thirds consecutive scoreless innings while filling in for Franco during this streak. So it's not like Anthony Young was just terrible. He just had terrible luck. Now, he wasn't a great pitcher, but as Young would actually point out in future interviews, if the Mets kept putting him out on the mound, he was doing something right. He was giving them a chance. It's just, again, the Mets teams of 91, 92, 93, and 94 were just really, really bad teams. Now, this losing stretch happened from May 6th, 1992 to July 24th of 1993. And if you go back through the newspaper clippings or your memories, the case may be, the Mets were an absolute poop show. Let's just put it that way. I already used one dirty word this show. We'll just leave it at that. The Mets were just a mess. And you think back to Vince Coleman, what he was doing with the team, Brett Saberhagen, what he was doing with the team, and you had the, you know, really, you know, red-ass Jeff Kent with the team. I mean, you just had a lot of nonsense. And of course, when you have a lot of nonsense and it's in New York, the media there blows it all up. And the Mets were an absolute circus. But still, somehow, Anthony Young got the loser tag on him because of this rather unfortunate stretch of time where in 27 consecutive pitcher of record situations, he got the loss. Now, when he was able to break that streak, I remember watching this game. I think it might have been on ESPN. It was actually such a big deal. You know, he had set the record moving past, who was it? Let me get the name correct here. Cliff Curtis. He had 23 consecutive losses from 1910 to 1911. Who was Cliff Curtis playing for? Let me see. The Boston Doves / Rustlers. That would be the predecessors to the Boston Braves. And again, if you go through your history books, the Boston Braves prior to 1914 were pretty terrible. So he had broken this record at 23. It got stretched out to 27. Nearly got off the hook after an extra inning situation where he almost got the win, but it turned out to be his 27th loss. Well, 4 days later, he finally gets the win as the Mets are hosting the expansion Marlins. It's a 3-3 tie. Chuck Carr scores a run. The Marlins go up 4-3, but the Mets get two in the bottom of the ninth against Brian Harvey, and this is amazing. It was just one of four saves that Harvey blew that year in 49 opportunities, and the Mets were able to bounce back, get the win, and that ended the streak right there. Now, that was pretty much the only good news that Anthony Young had, as the 1993 season mercifully came to an end. He was coming off an arthroscopic surgery procedure in 1994 when Dallas Green, the then manager of the Mets, who was not very tactful with his young pitchers, basically said that Young was not relying on some of his best pitches. He was not a very good pitcher, and he was about to go to Norfolk, where instead the Mets traded him in spring training of 1994, along with Otis Smith, a career minor leaguer, to the Chicago Cubs for Jose Vizcaino. Now, Young would struggle a little bit with the Cubs afterwards and finally was granted free agency after the 1995 season. And he went home to his hometown, Houston Astros, where he pitched in 1996. And it was a nice way for his major league career to wrap up, even though he wasn't able to latch on anywhere after the 1996 season. So it was a nice homecoming for him, as Young was able to star on the baseball team with the University of Houston, also had a chance to play football with him as well as a defender. But his major league career wraps up. He goes home. He works in a chemical plant for several years and gets back into the sport by being a youth coach. He would teach young pitchers, teenage boys, how to pitch properly. And that was his pride and joy up until his death in the summer of 2017. He was diagnosed with a brain tumor in, I believe, January 2017. And the doctors couldn't really do a biopsy on it because the tumor was on his brainstem. So they had it removed. He was going through chemotherapy. He seemed to be in pretty good spirits, but again, unfortunately died from that disease in the summer of 2017. Now, another interesting note about Anthony Young, he has a relative, Barrett Barnes, who was drafted by the Pittsburgh Pirates back in 2012. And Barrett Barnes is still playing in the minor leagues. He is actually a member of the Mets organization at last check, playing in Binghamton, which is their AA affiliate. Now, he's 27 years old. When you're 27 and you're in AA, it's time to fish or cut bait. So we'll see how long Barrett Barnes stays in the minor leagues. But he was longtime piece of the Pittsburgh Pirates minor league operations for many, many years, getting as high as AAA in Indianapolis in the 2017 season. He's an outfielder. So if you see Barrett Barnes getting that chance to play in the minor leagues, or in the major leagues, excuse me, remember that he is related to the late Anthony Young, a guy who unfortunately just got tagged with the loser tag way too often. A lot of those losses were not his fault. They were just terrible Mets teams all throughout the time that he was in New York City. All right, let's move on to Robert J. Lawson's favorite player. Yes, I pulled this card out of the pack and I just thought, Robert, this one's for you. Mike Pagliarulo. Yes, Pags, one of the cards that Robert seemed to get out of every pack that he opened up. It's my Zane Smith is Robert's Mike Pagliarulo, you know, that one player that you always pull from a card time and time again. Well, Pagliarulo, as you can detect, of Italian heritage. He is from Medford, Massachusetts, and he played for many, many years, mostly with the New York Yankees, but later on with San Diego, also the Twins, the Orioles, went overseas to Japan in 1994 and was able to wrap up his career back in the States with the Texas Rangers in 1995. Now, he was drafted by the Yankees in the sixth round of the 1981 Major League Baseball draft, joined the Yankees in 1984 and spent over 5 years there before getting traded to the San Diego Padres, and that was in the middle of the 1989 season. Interesting story with the trade for the Yankees here, Mike Pagliarulo. He was traded with Don Schulz to the Padres for a player to be named later and Walt Terrell. Now, the player to be named later was Freddie Tolliver. And if there was ever a player who could be nicknamed, a player to be named later, anyone to have a nickname of just PT, let's see, player to be named later, P PTBNL. There we go. It would be Freddie Tolliver, because Tolliver was the player to be named later in a 1981 trade between the Yankees and the Reds. And then he was the player to be named later in a 1985 trade between the Reds and the Phillies. And then he was the player to be named later in the 1989 trade between the Yankees and the Padres, which also involved Mike Paliarulo. So again, just an interesting little footnote to Paliarulo's career that Freddie Tolliver was always tagging around as the player to be named later. He would be granted free agency in 1990. He had the good fortune to sign with the Minnesota Twins in 1991. He was the Twins' starting third baseman, won a World Series with them, of course, and would play with the Twins through the middle of the 1993 season, where he was traded to the Baltimore Orioles for a player to be named later. No, not Freddie Tolliver. It's actually a young man named Eric Schulstrom, who was traded for Mike Paliarulo, as Freddie Tolliver was able to breathe a huge sigh of relief there. Let me see if there's any interesting notes here on Eric Schulstrom here. Was he also a player to be named later? Yes, he was, actually, in a trade involving the Padres, of all teams. Let me look this up here real quick. Yeah, traded by the Baltimore Orioles with a player to be named later for Craig Lefferts. All right, so he wasn't the player to be named later, but he was involved in a trade for a player to be named later, but that was not the case there. Okay, let's get back to Mike Paliarulo, shall we? As he was part of the team in Minnesota that won the World Series in 91, as I mentioned, traded to Baltimore in 1993, goes over to Japan in 1994, comes back in 1995, wraps up his career with the Texas Rangers. Now, he would move on to become a hitting coach throughout for several teams, and in fact, in the Pirates organization, was the hitting coach for the AAA Indianapolis Indians from 2013 through 2014. And then the Miami Marlins hired Paliarulo as their hitting coach in 2016. He was unceremoniously let go from that position 20 games into the 2019 season. He was just labeled the guy that is totally at fault for this terrible Marlins team that got off to a bad start. And that's rather unfortunate, as Pags is an alum of the University of Miami. So his 3+ years at Miami came to a rather ignominious end there in April of 2019. By the way, his son Michael Jr., a member of the Ivy League champion Dartmouth Big Green baseball team from 2009. And the last card that we pulled, I chuckle every time I see this player or his cards, because I think of a punk rock song every time I see this player. We're talking about Louis Soho. And if you listen to punk rock music in the mid-90s, there's a band called Rancid. Rancid had a lot of college radio hits, a couple of hits that got into popular music as well. Certainly not like a top 10 song, but songs that if you heard them, you would know, oh yeah, that's Rancid. Well, they had a song in 1995 called Ruby Soho. And if you listen to the song Ruby Soho and you replace the words Ruby Soho with Louis Soho, it's a fun sing-along for the entire family. Well, Louis Soho from Venezuela was brought into the major leagues primarily as a utility infielder, and he came up through the Toronto Blue Jays organization, and there was really nothing special about Louis Soho except for the fact that he always found himself in the right place and the right time. This is a great example for little league ball players, and especially parents. You know, you're son or daughter may not excel in any particular part of the game, but if they consistently play the game well and they show up and they care about winning and you know, they can be plugged into any position or any situation as a pinch runner or a defensive replacement or whatever, your child can actually succeed as part of the team. Louis Soho is a testament to that, as he is a 4-time World Series champion, not because he had a bat like Derek Jeter, not because he had a gold glove like some of his other teammates, not because he was the undisputed team leader. It's because he was a serviceable ball player who was coveted by many top baseball teams, and he represented himself and the team well year after year after year. He'd go on to win four World Series, technically five, actually, when you think about it. And let's go through the resume here real quickly. As I said, came up through the Blue Jays organization in 1990. He was actually part of a big trade as well, as he was sent to the California Angels in a package that the Blue Jays netted Devon White with. So he, as well as Junior Felix, go out to California for Willie Frazier, Marcus Moore, and Devon White. Also, a player to be named later, Ken Rivers, a career minor leaguer, sent in the deal to complete the trade. So he was part of the trade that netted the Blue Jays a very big part of their world championship teams in 1992 and 93. Not as big of a trade as the Fred McGriff and Tony Fernandez for Joe Carter and Roberto Alomar deal, but pretty substantial for the Blue Jays, as Devon White would not only be a speedy center fielder for many years, but also had a pretty good bat, pretty good leadoff option for Cito Gaston's Jays for several seasons. Now, what's interesting is the Angels would eventually trade Soho back to the Blue Jays after the 1992 season. Soho goes to Toronto for Kelly Gruber and cash. Now, that was a very controversial trade because the Angels claimed that the Blue Jays knew that Gruber's throwing arm was toast, that he had some damage in his shoulder, and that the Blue Jays knowingly sent damaged goods to the Angels in the trades. There was a lot of hubbub around that. Well, as a utility infielder, again, a guy who was called on very rarely, in fact, he only played 19 games in the 93 season, he was a member of a world championship team. And on October 15th, shortly after the World Series ended, he was granted free agency. Now, he would sign with the Seattle Mariners, again, an up-and-coming team, 94 through 96, or most of the 96 season, I should say, as he was waived by the Mariners in August of 96, where he is then picked up by the New York Yankees. What did I say about right place and right time? Again, a guy who, you know, in 1996 didn't really stand out offensively. You could kind of plug him in here and there. He only played 18 games with the Yankees. He was added to the postseason roster, and it was a smart move by Joe Torre, because even though he didn't get a single plate appearance in the 96 ALDS, he did get some batting time in the 96 ALCS, going 1-for-5 over three games. And then he appeared in five of the six games against the Atlanta Braves. He went 3-for-5 with a double and an RBI. So he picks up his second World Series ring while with the Yankees in 1996. Of course, he would pick up another one in 1998 as well as 1999. Granted free agency after the 1999 season, signs with the Pittsburgh Pirates. Again, kind of has just this Louis Soho-style season where he appears in just 61 games. Hits .284. The Pirates decide to dump him in August in exchange for Chris Sperling. So it's 2000. He's with the Yankees. Guess what? The Yankees are going to win another World Series. And this time, Soho actually had a key moment in this series. In fact, it was in Game 5, score tied 2-2, two outs on the ninth inning. Soho singles to center. He drives in Jorge Posada to break a tie. Scott Brosius also scores on a bad throw to home plate. The Yankees win their 26th World Series. And here's Louis Soho, Mr. Average Infielder, with his fifth World Series ring, which is just amazing. Now, here's what's even more amazing. As he would continue to play with the Yankees in 2001, participated in that seven-game series, which the Arizona Diamondbacks won. Well, the Yankees didn't have room for him in 2002, so he retires. He becomes a manager in the AA level with the Yankees farm system, the Norwich Navigators, leads the team to the Eastern League Championship. And after managing the Navigators, Soho gets the invite to Old Timers Day. So he shows up to Old Timers Day, hits a game-winning home run off of Ron Guidry, of all people. And the Yankees, near the end of the season, actually re-sign him as an active player. He appears in three games to finish up the season. And there's much debate if Louis Soho is the only Yankee in history to play in the Old Timers game and then later return in the regular season. Of course, the Yankees getting to the World Series again in 2003. They would lose to the Florida Marlins in six games. So it's just amazing how Luis Soho just seems to drop into these championship teams. So again, that's a really good lesson, not only for young ball players, but especially for family members. You're always pushing your kid to be the best ball player, which you should do. But there is success in being, I don't want to say anonymous, but just being a part of the team. And Luis Soho was not known for his bat. He was not known for his glove. He was speedy, so you know he had that asset to him. But for a guy who had a career batting average of .261, 36 home runs, was never a regular in his position, and a guy who got moved around from team to team. Remember, Blue Jays to Angels to Mariners to Yankees to Pirates back to Yankees. The guy won 5 World Series. So it's a good lesson that if you're good enough to play, but you're good enough to be used in any situation and you have a good attitude about it, who knows? You too can have 5 World Series by the end of your playing career 14 years later. One final note on Luis Soho after his re-debut, if you will, his re-emergence with the Yankees in 2003. He would be the third base coach for the team in 2004 and 2005, later on twice serving as manager of the Tampa Yankees. He was there from 2006 through 2009, came back in 2013. In between then, he was also the manager of the Venezuela national baseball team in 2006, 2009, and 2013. And since his second stint in Tampa, he has been the third base coach in Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, was also an assistant field coordinator for the Yankees and manager of the Gulf Coast League Yankees East. The latest news on Luis Soho, he's the new manager of the Spanish national baseball team. And something tells me, because Luis Soho just dropped in here, the Spanish national baseball team is going to win something very special in some international tournament sooner than later. All right, that's our look at some of the random selections from the box of 92 Fleer Ultra Series 1 cards that we had. And it was a lot of fun going through this box and seeing what you could find with this just gorgeous set. And again, the good side of the junk wax era is that these cards are still plentiful. So that's the bad thing. The good thing, though, is that because they are so plentiful, they're pretty darn cheap, and you can get some pretty good deals, and you don't have to look too hard. Just go on eBay, go to your local card shop or to a nearby card show, and if somebody has a Fleer Ultra box, they're probably selling it for about $10, and that's a lot cheaper than some of the other premium sets. That's still cheaper than some of the top stadium club or upper deck boxes at the same time. You can get them for a good $5 or $10 less than what you would pay for those boxes. So some pretty good deals to be had out there. All right, don't forget that our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed is open 24/7. So feel free to comment about this show or the card set we talked about or any of the players that we talked about. And also don't forget, if you could please, you got a few extra bucks on you, feel free to make a cash donation to paypal.me/waxecstatic, as your funds will help purchase some of the cards that we talk about on this show, and any excess product that we have from the purchases will be delivered to Commons for Kids sometime within the next few months. Our next show will be 2 weeks from today. That is Friday, December the 6th. That'll drop at noon Eastern via Audioboom and all of the various channels that link up to it. And we will be taking a look at some of those grocery cards, Kellogg's, Post's, Hostess. We've got some gems to share with you, not only from the cereal aisle, but we also found a few more older bargain bin cards here. Not in great shape, but just a thrill to have. A couple of 1948 Leaf cards, a 1934 Gaudi card as well. We'll share those with you in our next show. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.